Welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody, to a very special podcast this evening here, recording here in the evening of Wednesday, February 23rd. I'm Chad Sherwood, joined with John Tytel and David Griggs, a pair of Hoops HD regulars. But our very special guest tonight is the Southland Commissioner, as well as the current chair of the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Selection Committee, Tom Burnett. Tom, first of all, thanks for joining us, and how are you doing this evening?
Dad, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. It's always great to catch up with you guys, and been tracking you throughout the season, and appreciate the great enthusiasm you had for our game and this little exercise that I'm involved with.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you following us, and I think we've got a bunch of questions we want to ask you and touch base with you about the selection committee and what's going on and the season and the bracket reveal from this past weekend. But I think I want to ask you first about something in your other role as Southland Commissioner, because there was some huge news today out of your conference. Big entertainment coming to the Southland tournament this year. Am I correct?
Well, yeah, we let the cat out of the bag earlier today, and I know you guys saw that on Twitter. Red Panda is coming to our Southland tournament this year, and we, you know, actually looking back, we had Red Panda booked for the 2020 tournament that unfortunately we had to cancel midstream. So we're bringing her back, and couldn't be more excited about it. As you all know, how popular she is around the country at these college basketball games.
Yes. Chad tried to argue that it would be highly entertaining if I tried to do that. I don't doubt that it would be, but it would probably end badly.
I guess
I might agree with you, because it'd be the same for me.
I guess the bad news for you, Tom, is I guess you won't actually be able to be there, because you're going to be in the selection committee room at that time, right?
Yeah, I fortunately I've seen Red Panda previously, and very entertaining, and I will have to miss her this time.
All right, but let's go to here. Tom, you actually were on TV over the weekend. We all saw you on the preseason or the midseason bracket preview reveal. I think I got the names right there, where the committee's top 16 teams were revealed. I know people found it interesting. I know, without getting into any specific teams or anything, I guess my first question about all that, though, was a question that Dave and I were just asking each other off the air, was, did the committee actually do a full 68 team seed list, or did you just look at the top 16 when you met and put this together?
We did not do the full bracket, and you know, that's an interesting question. You know, a lot of people think that, much like other bracketologists, you know, who either do this for a living or as a hobby or as, whatever the case may be, and we're very appreciative of that. The committee does not do a full 68 team bracket until Selection Sunday. And that's just not part of our purview to do that. So we're not focused on things like first four out, first four in, last four, you know, first four buys, all of that, that we read with great interest on other websites and such, and follow that as well. But we do not do the full exercise until the very end. So yes, to answer directly, more directly the question, the committee does an abbreviated version of this, and has for a long time. It's just that recently, for the sixth time this year, we've put that, you know, the result of that process on television. But this was always the traditional orientation meeting for new committee members to learn or go through the process as a practice run, and, you know, ahead of the real selection week process that's now just 2 weeks away, as we know. But it's something that we go beyond 16. We don't stop at 16. We go a little bit farther down the list, because, as you well know, we go through a extensive series of scrubbing exercises that we need to make sure that those teams that might be behind whoever might be 16 have an opportunity to scrub north, so to speak, on the list. And so we probably go anywhere to 20 to 24 teams in the initial practice here. And then what you see is the 16. And then we made reference to three teams that were just really right outside our group of that we release on the top four seed lines.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Sorry. Oh, I was just going to say, like, of those protected seeds, Tom, the one seeds, I guess when you get into measuring the quality of a resume, is it more or less the number of quad one wins, the number of quad two wins, or do you sort of look at, like, beyond that, the quality of the quad one win? I've got some numbers here, and I'll try. The one seeds that you guys selected, 59-1 at home. If you're the one team that won that one game, I would think, would that maybe be worth more than somebody that might have more quad wins, but none of that quality? That is a simple question that I just asked complicatedly.
Sure, I understand. And back to the beginning of the question, certainly the when we look at a team sheet and we talk about things like net and metrics and such, you know, we're seeing all the information displayed in front of us. And certainly the conference monitoring program helps us in that regard as well. But, you know, when we're looking at, you know, unless we'll just use Gonzaga as an example, we're not only looking at their quad one record, but there's the top half of quad one. There's a bottom half of quad one. We split quad two the same way. So, you know, not only do we want to see quad one in total, we want to see, you know, not only what you're doing at home against the top 30 schools, but we'll break it down what you're doing, you know, in the top half, 1-15. The same applies in quad two, with the top half would be if you're at home, net teams 31-55. So we're really breaking that down quite a bit. And, you know, so I would say when we're looking at these resumes, we're looking at, you know, obviously, as you heard me on the show Saturday, you've heard other committee reps say, we're looking at the entire body of work, very important to us. There's no question at all. And you guys know the league I represent in all of this as well. You know, we're not going to get the same opportunity to play at home as some of these other teams do. But, right. You know, this is kind of the system that we have in place, and certainly the policies and procedures we have to honor.
Yeah. And Tom, I guess kind of on that topic, I guess, of the smaller schools, I guess, you know, is there any extra credit maybe given for a team that builds up a huge resume with tons of wins and very few losses against coming from one of these, what we call the under the radar conferences, the smaller conferences, yeah, versus a team that that has all those extra chances but maybe loses a few more times?
Yeah, and I don't know that I would speak to anyone currently, but I'll give you an example out of our own conference. You guys remember a few years ago Stephen F. Austin won 30 games one year and just had a tremendous, you know, went undefeated in our conference. And perhaps that was seen as of significance, certainly by the selection committee at the time, but again, before I joined the committee, and I was an outsider like anyone else at the time, but I would say that, you know, an overwhelmingly successful conference record is going to get examined, and the committee takes that under strong consideration, because we do know that some of those programs aren't going to get as many quad one, even quad two opportunities. And, you know, honestly, you look at their team sheet, they may skew heavily into Q3 and Q4 with their schedule, but a lot of that is their conference schedule that they can't control. So if they can move through that schedule in an overwhelming manner, then certainly that is going to get the committee's attention, just like it would, you know, we'd get the attention of a quad one team with a very high net. We're going to want to know why that net is so high, and we're going to examine further. We're going to look under the hood. We're going to kick the tires. We're looking at every bit of measurement we can. Then we've got the firsthand reports from our conference monitors. So, you know, The mid-major programs that may only get limited opportunities, I would say it's very important that they take advantage of those opportunities. Now, they may only get three of those, for example. Were they able to win one of those three games? Did they go 0-3, or did they go 0-5, whatever the case might be? So, you know, they're really going to have to show the committee something, and certainly that overwhelming successful conference record is something that the committee cannot ignore.
Yeah.
I'm going to, John, I'll toss it over to you. I know you've got a few questions also.
Hey, Tom, John Tytel. I got to interview you several years ago, and it was a blast. And just figured that I'd follow up on a couple things that you mentioned back then, such as I believe you mentioned that in over 30 years of working in a conference office, you've never watched as much basketball in your life as when you're a selection committee member, which makes perfect sense. And I'm actually glad to hear it. Can you just take us through like a typical Wednesday night for you in late February?
Okay, a typical Wednesday night is, I would tell you that I have probably spent, and I do this really twice a week, at the beginning of the week and then leading into the weekend, I kind of keep my own list of, I guess you could call it Tom Burnett's poll. And it's just a very simple one-page spreadsheet of who I think might be the top 35 teams at a given time. And again, as committee members, we work independently in that regard, where we come to the table and submit an initial ballot on that selection Wednesday of what we think the our order would be, and who's an at-large team already, and then who we think are under consideration. So for me, that's probably about 35 teams that I'm really supremely focused on throughout. So I will have come into a Wednesday night with an updated list. And I'm updating it through what happened last night, such as the Villanova-UConn game, other games like that, Baylor, Oklahoma State, things like that. So I'm watching all of that. And Wednesday night is certainly getting a good sense of what the television schedule looks like, what we might find on streaming, all of that. And then maybe just like any of you or just the casual fan out there, I'm flipping around, watching everything I can. I'm trying to watch every halftime show because I do want to hear what the analysts say, the studio folks. I want to see the late night shows on ESPN and CBS Sports Network, excuse me. And just really like a sponge, soak it all in. And you know, that can be easy to do sometimes, but it's maybe hard to do sometimes as well. So I'm just trying to watch it all, and that's kind of next to impossible, but that's kind of a Wednesday night for me. My wife usually gives up on me and I run her out of the living room because I've got, you know, my big screen TV, my couple of iPads going at the same time. And I'm not trying to ignore her, but she understands my role on the committee. I've got to be focused on this and just essentially trying to get a basic understanding of everything that's happening in the game.
Yeah. You mentioned your top 35. Do you start putting that together on night one when there's, you want to talk about a busy night? I think there was like 180 games or something. or do you just sort of, it like, is it around Christmas? I guess, when do you start evaluating teams in that manner?
Well, you know, I'll start to look at, you know, everything from night one. My personal grid here, and the chair of the committee is a little bit different role. I'm the one person on the committee that does not have a specific conference monitoring assignment. The other 11 members split up the conferences, primary or secondary, and usually they have either five or six leagues that they're monitoring, and they do a great job with that. But the chair does not have a specific assignment. So I'm kind of a free agent. I get to, you know, kind of float around and watch things. And then also too, I get out to a lot of games. I've seen many of the top teams in the country in person, and will continue to do that as I can. Living here in the Dallas area, we can get to a lot of games. So certainly want to get eyes on the teams as well. But I will tell you my documentation personally, and as I've developed as a committee member over a few years, has been, it's usually around that Christmas to New Year's break. Well, I'll start to, I feel like I've got enough information to start formulating what my list looks like, and certainly get into a mode where at least twice a week, sometimes daily, probably as we get into next week, very much daily before we head off for selections. that first full week of March. But it's usually around the holidays where I really kind of lock in on what my documentation and what I think I need as I head to selections later on in March.
Tom, I want to ask you this, that you actually have, I believe, either four or five new members of the committee this year, which is a lot compared to most years where there's normally only two, maybe three new members. But having served on the committee for 5 years, does what the committee values most change as the membership changes? Have you experienced that? For example, in the past, has maybe as members go in and off, go on and off the committee, maybe you have more members who want to focus in on one metric or a certain area, or do you find that there's a consistency of from year to year of what the committee's really looking at when they're evaluating teams?
Well, there's a certain consistency in that, you know, there's one set of, you know, principles for selection, seeding, and bracketing, and you know, I think you guys are familiar with that. It's a public document; everyone knows. But however, within that framework, each of the members can work independently, and we all come to the table with, you know, whether it's my list or it's someone like Michael Bryan or Jamie Pollard, other committee members, Bernadette McGlade, they're coming to the table in the same manner, and they've got their list, and it's probably very, you know, it could be very different, I should say, from Tom's list or Mike's list. But, you know, I just think that as the committee changes, you know, you obviously you've got different individuals who have differing day jobs, so to speak. You know, again, we're all administrators. We're either athletic directors or conference commissioners. But certainly you may have some come in, you know, like Barry Collier this year coming in from Butler, not only a very accomplished athletic administrator, but, you know, he was also a coach at the highest levels and very successful during his career. So he brings some basketball chops, and other committees do as well. Other committee members do as well. But, you know, certainly what Barry may value may be slightly different than what Tom values or Bernadette values. But, you know, we all come from our own spot, and there could be some changes, but we are still working under at least a consistent framing of what our responsibilities are supposed to be.
Yeah, and I guess the reason I ask that is because I hear a lot of people saying, oh, this team is going to be in because 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the committee took a team with this very similar profile. My response has always been, well, it's not the same 10 or 12, now 12 people, so that doesn't mean anything necessarily.
Yeah, but my response is also, yeah, well, what about maybe the teams they didn't take did something else this year. You know, you can't categorically look at
it. Yeah, that, as you know, I mean, what happened 2 years ago has no application to this year.
Right.
As far as specific teams go, now certainly policies may be the same or they may be changed as well. Obviously, during my tenure, we went from the RPI system to the NET system. And so that was a change as well. So things can change, but overall, the committee's directive, I would say, oh gosh, and if not 10 out of 10 instances, at least 9.9 out of 10 instances, it remains the same.
John, I know you had a couple more.
Yeah, I know, Tom, you've previously spoken about the importance of intent to schedule for mid-major teams, yeah, who try to go on the road against Power 5 teams. So just to hone in on that a little more, is it just an impact on a team? I understand if you can't speak to specifics, but to give you some specific examples, a team like Loyola who won at DePaul and at Vandy, or a team as well like Vermont who didn't win at Maryland and at Providence but went on the road to play those big-time teams.
Yeah, another great question. And, you know, and the intent to schedule discussion, really, it's not only applicable to mid-major teams. I would say it's across the board. And, you know, certainly you can identify teams that have had that intent to schedule, and that's very clear. And then you see, you know, maybe the teams they did schedule may normally be, you know, fairly prominent, and, you know, having a bad year, just for example. You know, no one expects this team, usually a top 100 team, for whatever reason, they're 295 or whatever. So some of that you can't control. And at the end of the day, you don't get an exception for that. You still have to live with your results, who you played, where you played them, that type of deal. That hasn't changed. But, you know, we've seen, you know, honestly, some other programs at higher levels, maybe higher leagues, that maybe instead of an intent to schedule, there was an intent to win. And sometimes an intent to win games is very different than an intent to schedule aggressively to put your program in a position to gain an at-large opportunity. Or if you're from a mid-major and you're a one-bid league, you know, climbing up that seed line as opposed to defaulting to maybe a 14, 15, or 16. So we see that across the board. It's very important. So when there are those mid-major programs that are kind of on the board in front of us, intent to schedule is certainly, you know, at the forefront of what we're looking at, in addition to, obviously, they would have won a lot of games that have, you know, come to our attention and that type deal. So, but intent to schedule is across everyone. It's not just the mid-major programs.
Yeah, Tom, to kind of follow up on intent to schedule, you did a good job explaining about how you might play Power Five teams that didn't pan out. What kind of comes to mind, and again, I'll go back to one of the former Southland teams, Stephen F. Austin, I want to say it was 4 or 5 years ago. I forget exactly how the ad on Basketball Travelers read, but it was something along the lines of, we'll go anywhere for basically nothing. And they still couldn't get a team to play them. Now, to me, that my definition of intending to schedule, I don't know how you can intend to schedule more apparently than that. Does that ever come into a play? Like, it's maddening when you're in that situation and then you're criticized for not playing anybody. Are the tables ever turned to where it's like, well, why didn't anybody go play them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know that I've heard it phrased that way, but I think we are cognizant of, and again, using that Stephen F. Austin example from a few years ago, they couldn't even get road games in the state of Texas after one of those runs here. And that was hard deal. And I remember they finally got a game at Baylor and they went over there and happened to beat them in Waco, which, you know, it's hard to do, obviously, and very hard to do now, but it was tough then as well. But, you know, so that didn't probably help their cause going forward after that as well. But, you know, we don't turn it around, and we're probably just not knowledgeable enough of, you know, it was a Power Five school, as an example, denying opportunities for mid-major schools to play a game, even on the Power Five school's home court. We're just not knowledgeable enough or know about that. We'd probably hear about some things anecdotally from coaches and such. And as a conference commissioner, I would probably hear something like that from our coaches, is that, hey, we tried to play this team or that team and they wouldn't return our calls, or, you know, just said, you know, may have even admitted, hey, you guys are too good. We can't take that chance.
Yeah.
Tom, I want to ask about the eye test, which I know you previously said that is words you've never uttered before, but that you know it a great team when you see it. I know the greatest teams when I see them, like Gonzaga or Arizona, but in terms of the teams a little below that, like, I thought Villanova was a great team, but then they lost. I thought UCLA was a great team, but they stubbed their toe here and there. So how do you recognize a great team?
Well, you know, from the committee's perspective, and you can't deny what your eyes see. Let's be very clear about that. And when we see something and we know it's good, we have to recognize that. As a human being, how can you not recognize that? But the actual term eye test is something that, you know, as we have engaged with the coaches community, the NABC and that group, you know, they don't want us using eye test. And thus, you know, they also wanted us to get more involved in looking at other metrics and some of the predictives and all of that. So, you know, the eye test for me is something I probably hear more about on television, honestly, when I listen to some of the analysts and watch some of the, you know, pregame halftime type shows and hear, some of the coaches who might be now in those roles talking about the eye test. And really, it's something that just doesn't come into the committee conversations. But there's no denying the fact that there's a lot of teams that you look at and you know they're good. But it's not just that's what we hang our hat on. I mean, similarly, we just don't hang our hat on the net number. The net number is really kind of this, you know, the sorting tool, as we've talked about, that makes us look at other things. The other metrics, you know, certainly strength of schedule, road record, how they're doing in the quads. Because when we look into the quads, that's how your opponents really are. And that's what really helps us there. But eye test is something we don't talk about. We hear about it, but you can't deny that, you know, when your eyes, you know, show you something that looks pretty good. But like anything else, it causes us to say, well, I want to look further into this team. But you know, eye test or not, you know, Gonzaga is a good basketball team, as an example.
Amen.
I'm suspicious of it anyway.
Another thing I wanted to ask about, I know you take player availability and perhaps even coach availability very seriously. And while I understand if you can't go into specifics, I was curious, does it matter what caused the absence and or availability? For example, I know that a lot of guys missed time with COVID. Other guys missed time with injury, like a Colin Castleton of Florida. Other coaches missed time due to behaving badly, like Juwan Howard at Michigan. So does the reason for the absence or availability matter?
It really doesn't. You know, I guess before COVID, you know, this was usually an injury issue. It might have been a suspension issue on occasion, but it was something we were always cognizant of on tracking injuries. Obviously, with COVID coming, you know, to the forefront here over the last couple of years, we have had to really treat, you know, COVID absences much like we would do injuries. And the same for the coaches. If the coaches were out with COVID, that was taken into account as well. Obviously, the other incident you referenced on occasion, you know, we have had coaches suspended. And certainly the committee is very aware of when someone is out, whether it's that instance or an injury or a COVID. We have a support system through the NCAA staff that just any team we can call up through the National Stats Program and see who played, who didn't play, who was limited, and we can ask questions why they were limited. We'll have a separate sheet that may speak to when coaches were out because of COVID primarily, but certainly other reasons, as you mentioned. So we do have that at our fingertips, and that's just part. We looked at it this last week just to kind of reconfirm, you know, those schools that had COVID pauses. So, yes, player availability, coach availability comes into play. I will say we still have to honor the results. And, you know, there may be a player or coach out and the team goes undefeated. There may be other times when the record's very different, but we are taking that into account, and it does factor into kind of what we decide ultimately in selection week.
So, Tom, what you're saying is that because Danny Hurley wasn't around for most of the game last night, UConn's win over Villanova doesn't count, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
But sure. Seriously, when it comes to injuries, though, when you look at teams, do you also look at a team that may have had a big win, one or two big wins, tier quad one wins, but the team they were playing was missing some of its key players? Could that kind of almost say, hey, they may not get as much credit for that win because they beat a shorthanded team?
I don't know that I could recall an issue like that in my time on the committee. We still have to honor a win or a loss at the end of the day. And I think, again, we take that into account, and independently we figure out, well, is that a, you know, a greater or a lesser, you know, quality? And again, independently, we come to our decisions on what we think that means. You know, here's an example this year. You know, Providence wins at Wisconsin earlier this year, I believe, but Wisconsin did not have Johnny Davis available. Now, you know, that certainly hampered Wisconsin, but you can't penalize Providence because Davis wasn't in the game. And there's other examples of that. You still have to give Providence every bit of credit for winning that game. And that certainly goes into kind of where the committee saw them and will maybe continue to see them as we go through these final couple of weeks before selections. But, you know, it's something that weighs pretty heavily, and we've got a responsibility to track all of that and be as accurate as we can.
Well, that's really interesting, Tom. I've never heard that explained that way, that it's a good point that you can't punish Providence because they couldn't control the situation. Yeah.
That's correct.
This is basically, I sort of asked this earlier, but I'm going to kind of ask it as how it pertains to the under the radar teams. You mentioned that each committee member has about 5 or 6 conferences that they monitor. Are they monitoring basically teams that they think could make the tournament, or are they monitoring the entire league? And I guess where I'm going with this is that there's situations to where teams are nowhere near the bubble. They're not even on the bubble for being on the bubble. In the OVC, for instance, Morehead State, nowhere close, but at home, they're really strong. And while it may be a tier 3 win if Belmont or Murray goes there and wins, would the person monitoring the OVC kind of point out, well, it's kind of hard to win at Morehead State. They don't lose at home. UAB, another team with an excellent home record. North Texas just won there. I guess what I'm getting at is that could under the radar teams get credit for winning games that are arguably very hard to win, even if they're not against teams that you're looking at for selection?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly as I recall the discussions, whether it was in previous years or even this year, I think there's an acknowledgement by all of us that, and I think, you know, talk to any coach in America, conference play is really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard. And I don't care what conference you're in, to go on the road and to play and compete and possibly, you know, eke out a win and be successful in that regard, that's not easy to do. And I don't care if you're a Power 5 or, you know, someone that may be under the radar, you're going to have a hard time on the road. And I think there's an acknowledgement that winning on the road is very important. And I will tell you that many times in our discussions, you know, we will note those teams that have gone on the road. And then further in the conference monitoring program, as we talk to the league offices, and, you know, that there's 4 of those calls a year with each conference, they're able to explain the intricacies, the difficulties in their conference. And that's where we probably pick up on, hey, you know, Morehead State is really successful at home, or, you know, UAB was so successful and North Texas went in there and knocked them off. So, you know, we're looking at that as well. And, you know, we may not get so far in the weeds where we know all 350 some odd teams and their home advantages they have, but certainly the notable ones we will know about.
Tom, one other question here. When you're looking at a team profiles, there are some teams out there with some very strange losses on their profiles. I can think of several this year that have lost tier 4 games at home and yet have some collections of some really incredible wins. Does the committee, is when you look at these...
Chad's a Rutgers team like that, alum, by the way.
Yeah, I am a Rutgers alum, by the way. I didn't want to mention a specific team, but yes, I am a Rutgers alum. How much does the committee maybe overlook 1 or 2 really bad losses when a team has done something just incredible at the top of the profile? Or does that really come into effect too in choosing and seeding them?
Well, again, you really can't afford to ignore anything. But, you know, it's maybe not specific to any team. You're certainly not going to ignore the great things they've done. And also, you know, again, not ignore what might have happened in Quad 3 or even Quad 4 at times. And it kind of, again, goes back to that entire body of work. Certainly, you know, the committee once upon a time had a focus on final 10 games, and then I think it adjusted to final 12 games, and then we got rid of that altogether, and now we're looking at the entire schedule. So certainly what you did in November, you know, can prove it is really just as important as what you do in March, but we're looking at all of that, and that's just where, again, independently, we've all got to come to a conclusion on what that team profile means to us, and certainly not overlooking maybe the bad things on a resume, and then not getting too overwhelmed with the great things as well. But so it's just finding that balance. And, you know, some teams, you know, again, do get better as the team as the season goes along. They may have had player availability issues as well. So if we see a team with a lot of quad one wins, but this curious quad four loss, we're going to want to know, in that quad four loss, was there something up? Were they on a COVID pause? Were there some starters out? Was there another issue? So we're going to investigate that and find out maybe what the issues could have been. And maybe sometimes there are no issues. Someone just gets beat, you know, that's someone else's night. And you take that into account as well. And that may be one blip in a schedule of 27, 28, 29 games. And then the committee just has to kind of figure out what that means to them as we move teams into the tournament and begin to seed and bracket.
I want to make sure, Tom, we get a chance to talk about the Southland tournament. Starts on March 9th with 8 teams in Katy. You got one team in New Orleans who's won 12 of their past 13, another one in Nichols who's won 7 in a row, and they meet each other in the game of the year for the regular season finale on March 5th in Thibodaux. Do you see this conference tourney as a two-team race, or do you think it's wide open because 6 of your past 7 champs are gone when Abilene and Stephen F. switched to the WAC last summer?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I think certainly you have to honor, you know, the record so far, and you look at the top of the league, and you know, certainly it, you can't ignore what, UNO or Nichols have done. But that being said, you know, you guys remember we had the tip-off event in early January, and, you know, yeah. Southeastern Louisiana won that and played really well. And they're kind of sitting there in third. So, I wouldn't exclude them. And A&M Corpus Christi had a great out-of-conference schedule, a little bit more challenging in the league. And then behind that, you just don't know. I mean, it's just we played a full double round robin schedule. And, you know, so far UNO and Nichols, from a record standpoint, are looking really good. But, you know, you put our 8 on a neutral floor in Katy, Texas. There's no telling what can happen. But I'm certainly looking forward to the tournament. I think it'll be very exciting. And, you know, certainly looking forward to seeing who our champion will be.
Yeah, Tom, you mentioned that tip-off tournament, which I thought was a really innovative idea to get to take care of that kind of absence in the middle of January they may have had with only 14 games in the full double round robin. And I know that unfortunately hit kind of in the middle of COVID, and in fact your women's event got canceled because of COVID.
Yeah.
Is this something that we may see out of the Southland coming in future years, and maybe even other conferences to, you know, try to copycat you? What are we looking at for that, Tim? Because I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was a ton of fun to watch.
I think we watched every game.
well, thank you for number one. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate that and glad you provide that. You know, essentially the idea behind that was we just needed some additional games because of the lower number of conference games. And although we didn't count them as conference games, as it turned out. But I think what also helped us there was that, by starting our conference schedule a little bit later, our men's teams got to a point where, and our women's teams as well, we're going to be able to fully complete our schedule without any makeups. And that certainly is very, very grateful for that. And after all what happened with the Omicron variant. So, as it relates to the tip-off, I think that that could occur again. I think our athletic administrators are going to get together. They will be meeting actually during our tournament this year to talk about the future of that. You know, I couldn't speak to what other conferences might do, but, you know, through realignment, if there are other leagues that, have a reduced number of members, they might want to consider that. And we just had to fill that hole because it would have been really hard to get that any non-conference games during that week. So it was good that we could come together and play. And I think our teams were appreciative of that. And, you know, I think overall it's a really good thing, and we'll see if our members want to do that again.
Yeah. So I got kind of a concept here, Tom. This is kind of dangerous that I wanted you to comment on. Essentially, and it involves the under-the-radar schools again, where it seems like your path to getting inside the bubble is you have about 6 or 7 weeks at the beginning of the year to get the kind of wins that jump out into the committee, and then you go in the conference play, and it's a nightly exercise of not slipping on banana peels. You don't get the big showcase game or, hey, this would be a big win that would elevate us up. You're really holding serve night after night after night. Would the committee or the NCAA support an idea to where late in the year we had something similar to what used to exist with the ESPN Bracket Buster? The difference being that maybe the committee would match teams up, like in groups of two or three, where somebody got to play at home, somebody got to play on the road. I know logistically there is a lot to work out there, but as a concept, you know, Murray and Iona and Loyola Chicago. Yes, please.
Yeah, it's another great question. We, you know, we were part of the old Bracket Busters system as well. And, you know, really, I thought we got some really good benefit. You guys may be too young to remember. There was we had the Northwestern State team in 2006 that went to the Bracket Busters game and had a tough, I believe they were out at Weber State, so a tough place to go play. And as it turned out, Northwestern State won our league and then beat Iowa in the first round. And right. You know, what I remember is that Northwestern got a really good quality late season road game that at the time held up their RPI number, and I think may have influenced, you know, ultimately their seeding in the tournament. And, you know, there's some value and benefit there. And there were certainly other Bracket Busters matchups over time that allowed teams to at least hold their RPI ranking, or, you know, however the committee was looking at them at the time. So I think there's certainly value in that. I think the challenge there, that's really not under the purview of the basketball committee.
Yeah.
Scheduling is certainly the domain of the conferences. Non-conference scheduling is really under the domain of the institutions. So, you know, you're right. There's a lot of moving parts there. And, yeah, you know, there's a challenge in all of that. And I remember some of those challenges trying to arrange Bracket Buster matchups that sometimes they made a lot of sense, and sometimes they were a little bit of a head scratcher because you just had to fit all the teams together ultimately.
Yeah, you had to fit them all together. Essentially, it would be even more involved than the Buster was. You would essentially need 20 plus conferences all together in a scheduling agreement, which, you know, that would not be fun to organize. But if it were to happen, it's just, is there a way to manufacture opportunities late in the year for under the radar teams beyond holding serve, not slipping on that banana peel? Because really, Einstein's a genius. If you give him 1,000 basic math problems, he'll probably miss one. A really good team that has to hold serve night after night after night after night is going to slip up probably once or twice.
Yeah, and we see that all the time, and we're seeing even the best teams in the country that they're going to lose a conference game. Play is hard. It's just going to happen, and it can happen at home as well. But I think what these conferences would need that you speak of, they would need some reassurance, and I don't know how to do this. They would need some reassurance from the NCAA or the basketball committee that this would be meaningful, and I would fall short of, you know, probably answering every question and solving every problem on how you would reassure, you know, like, you know, say a Southland Conference team that by winning a game in that kind of arrangement, they would get special consideration. I really don't know how to do that. That's why experts like you guys can work all that out.
Yeah. Well, we'll start working the phones.
So, Tom, my last question.
All right, I look forward to it.
Yeah.
So, Tom, my last question. I know that you've been commissioner for almost two decades, but you're stepping down in April to become a full-time senior consultant to the new guy and the board of directors. How does it feel as you approach the big day? Are you excited or nervous or something else?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of all that. I've had a great run here as Southland Commissioner. You know, 19 years is a long time to do one of these jobs, but it's been a labor of love. And all I ever wanted to do was be a conference commissioner, and I got a chance to do that. Now I've had to refocus that. And, you know, all I want to do now is maybe something else in another chapter professionally and personally where I can, you know, help people and hopefully utilize you know, I guess what skill set I think I have and experience to help someone do some good things in the future. But really, as you guys know, we've gone through a lot of realignment, a lot of change. That perhaps has taken some toll. But, you know, it just gets to a point where you start to think about where's the conference going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. Well, there's a likelihood that, you know, that future, you know, probably doesn't include me as commissioner. And it's time for maybe some new, fresh leadership. And we've got just a brand new dynamic leader in Chris Grant, who comes from the Pac-12 conference, has worked with us the last few months, worked at Conference USA, has some great new initiatives and ideas. And I think really is going to be the one to, you know, take this conference on that next 5-10 year run that, you know, perhaps I was ready to relinquish. And, but it's all in a good place. Feel really good about the accomplishments we've had here and look forward to watching this conference continue to succeed in the future.
Tom, on that note, I do want to thank you again for joining us. It's been a great conversation. We just love having you on. But once again, I think we're pretty much out of time and maybe out of questions too. But but again, just thank you for joining us and you know, good luck. Go ahead with both your duties as Southland Commissioner for the rest of the year and with the big thing of, you know, getting the tournament selected and seated and bracketed up the next 2.5 weeks here.
Yeah, and if the committee gets stuck and needs our help, you know how to get in touch with us.
I've got your phone numbers, guys, and I would really leave you with this. You know, as you well know, we've got all of these bracketing, seating, selection procedures and such. I mentioned this on the show. It's really important for our committee and certainly the NCAA to get this tournament back on track, back on course. You know, I can't wait to get back to the 14 sites. I can't wait to go to Dayton. And certainly I can't wait to go to New Orleans for the Final Four and, you know, all the locations in between. And bring this tournament back out to the country and all of us get so excited on that first Thursday and Friday, like we always have. That's just a really strong focus for our committee. And we appreciate all of you guys and everyone else who great enthusiasts for this game. And there's nothing like it. And can't wait till we get to April in New Orleans. It's going to be fantastic.
Nothing better than April in New Orleans. I got to say, I'll be with you there. Whether or not there's a tournament there,
right. I think the country, in response to that, Tom, is ready for this in a way that they haven't been in a long time. So I hope it's a fantastic event.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, guys, it's always a pleasure, and whatever we can do for you guys, let us know.
Thanks again, very special guest, the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Selection Committee Chairman and the Commissioner of the Southland Conference, all sports, Tom Burnett. But on behalf of John Titel and David Griggs as well, I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a great evening.